May it please the court, I am Bane Kerr, Hutchinson Black and Cook, representing Carolyn Harner, the plaintiff appellant in this case. There are three reasons for reversing the judgment and remanding this case to trial. The first is that instruction number 21, the res ipsa loquitur instruction, misstated Colorado law by not shifting the burden of proof to the defendant to prove he was not negligent once the elements of res ipsa loquitur were made out. The second reason is that there was insufficient evidence that the defendant, Dr. Chapman, was not negligent even to meet the burden of production, even if Rule 301 applied, such that the jury should have been instructed that they must find the defendant was negligent if the res ipsa loquitur elements were made out. And third, there was other instructional and evidentiary error that cumulatively added to plaintiffs not receiving a fair trial in this case. In this case, 4 hours after a routine angiogram, the plaintiff's husband, Dr. Harner, died, his left chest full of blood. At autopsy, a perforation of his aorta, a mechanical hole caused by a puncture that matched the guide wire used in the catheter, was found to have produced the blood and caused the death. At trial, Dr. Chapman disputed that he had perforated the great vessel, the aorta, during the procedure on Dr. Harner, and he disputed that a perforation was the cause of death, but there was no dispute that had the perforation occurred, it would have been negligent. Five different witnesses, everyone who has ever participated in an angiogram, including Dr. Chapman, all said the same. No one in the cath lab at the time this happened over 5 years ago remembers the procedure, remembers that day. The record of it, the procedure log, which Dr. Chapman approved and signed, was tampered with and altered and is useless as a record of what happened. The film of it, which Dr. Chapman always creates as an invasive cardiologist doing angiograms, has never been found. So there none of the usual means of proof under standard in a standard negligence or medical negligence case are available, since all of the record of what happened is gone. But it is uncontested that it was if the perforation happened, it was negligent. How, when, and why exactly the aorta was punctured cannot be known and cannot be proven. The trial court ruled the elements of res ipsa loquitur were made out, but rejected plaintiff's tendered instruction that Dr. Chapman therefore then bore the burden of proof of proving he had not been negligent during the procedure. Unable to determine the specific acts that caused the injury and instructed that they could not hold the defendant at fault for the lost and tampered evidence, the jury necessarily had to conclude that plaintiff had not met her burden of proving negligence. This case turned on burden of proof.
Can I ask you, Mr. Kerr, two questions, but on this one, because there was an issue I had too. Tell me what supports what you just said, that the case turned on the burden of proof.
We don't know exactly, or we cannot say exactly what the jury deliberations were, but the only explanation that makes sense is that they could not, they did not know exactly what happened and what exactly what the negligence was, what the specific acts of negligence were, and they only had a burden of proof applying to the, that called on the plaintiff to show negligence, and they felt that they couldn't find that had been shown. I think that's a necessary conclusion.
All right, so in other words, I'm going to feed it back to make sure if I understood it. We know that the jury necessarily found that Mrs. Harner did not prove that the doctor was negligent by a preponderance of the evidence. We know that. And I think what you just said to me is that if the burden of proof was put on the doctor, that may well have made a difference. Is that essentially what your argument is? But we can't know for sure because we can't read the jury's mind or ask them under the rules.
Exactly. And if that burden of proof had not fallen on the plaintiff and then instead it had been the doctor's burden to show that he was not negligent during the procedure, I think you have to say the outcome not only might have, but very likely would have been different.
Can I ask you then to focus on this legal issue you've raised on the res ipsa and whether it shifts the burden of persuasion? We all know there's plenty of law out there that says, boy, this is a confused area. And it's this case, I think this is a difficult case because of that. Do you agree that res ipsa is an evidentiary presumption?
Yes.
All right. Then how do we not get into Rule 301, given that it's an evidentiary presumption? Sorry.
Well, it's a rule of evidence that was very well established at common law, has a very richly developed history as a rule of evidence in common law. Rule 301, I think, is best stated by Sheila Hyatt in the Colorado Evidence Law Treatise, is a default position. That must yield to conflicting precedent on evidentiary rules, and the precedent at issue is that of Weiss versus Axler, Supreme Court, as you all well know. The question is whether could Rule 301, the adoption of Rule 301 in 1980, have abrogated the Supreme Court rule and, you know, 100 years of jurisprudence on this issue? And the answer is no, according to the Colorado Supreme Court itself, after 301 in Stones Farm versus Deacon, which affirmed the continuing validity of Weiss versus Axler by relying on it, restating it, and using it in their holding in that case. And really, every single pronouncement of every single court and commentator since has said the same. It's Rule 301, modeled on Federal Rule 301, which similarly is a default rule that at least according to the treatises like McCormick, McCormick states that it does not extend to existing presumptions that shift the burden of proof. And there are examples, both statutory and common law presumptions federally, as there are in Colorado, that are unaffected by Rule 301. It's not a one-size-fits-all, all-inclusive rule that abrogates all the common law of presumptions at the time of its adoption. That would be my answer. This first issue of res ipsa loquitur instruction 21, is the one for de novo review, and it simply was instruction number 21, an incorrect statement of the law. And we have just been talking about that. Let me tick off a few of the other statements of the law that we talked about somewhat. Weiss versus Axler, and then after Rule 301, Stones Farm versus Deacon, Martin versus Menard, a division of the Court of Appeals, which restated the shifting of the burden of proof rule, relying on Stone Farm versus Deacon, the two opinions in Ochoa versus Barred by Judge Webb, which stated we are not persuaded the rule by the arguments about Rule 301 abrogating the rule, and relied instead on Stone Farm versus Deacon. And then in Kendrick versus Pippin at the Court of Appeals level, Judge Connolly's dissent went into an extended discussion of the robust Colorado doctrine of res ipsa under which the burden of proof shifts. At the Supreme Court level, reversing the Court of Appeals, that was a dissenting opinion of Judge Connolly. The concurring opinion of Justice Martinez also restated the burden of proof shifting rule, relying on Stones Farm versus Deacon, and all treatise and commentator authority say that's the rule in Colorado. Prosser, Restatement Second of Torts, McCormick, the Salzburg Treatise.
Mr. Kerr, if I can ask you relating to this issue, there's a lot of discussion both at the district court level, and Mr. Young also addresses it, I think, that Stone's Farm was dicta. And I guess my question for you is, does it matter? Because even if it's not, I mean, I think we could say the Supreme Court at least cited Weiss with approval. And so perhaps the argument, the stronger argument for your side here is that we can't say the Supreme Court overruled Weiss. I don't know if I'm right about that, so I'm asking.
Well, I certainly think you're right, Judge Gabriel. I think there are three problems with trying to circumnavigate around all of these statements of the laws, and especially Stones Farm versus Deacon as dicta. First, I don't believe it was dicta. I mean, the holding in Stones Farm versus Deacon was that the defendant, American, a company named American, I believe, had failed to meet its burden of overcoming the presumption, and the Supreme Court said that, that burden is the burden of proof by a preponderance of the evidence that it wasn't negligence. So it's that rule is a statement of law that's integral to the holding, and it's not dicta. If it were dicta, as you just said, it confirms that Weiss versus Axler is good law and controlling precedent after Rule 301. Rule 301 has not abrogated Weiss versus Axler, according to the Supreme Court, and it remains good law, and therefore it's, you know, it basically says the same thing as if it were dicta or not, because Weiss versus Axler is controlling. And then finally, it's the unequivocal statement of the unanimous Supreme Court of what the law in Colorado is, and that's what your de novo review consists of. What is the correct statement of Colorado law? We have the Supreme Court unanimously saying what Colorado law is, and that having been applied since in a number of other cases.
Mr. Kerr, although let me take you back to 1980 with the Montgomery elevator case, what do you make of that footnote which acknowledges Rule 301?
The Montgomery elevator, if I could first address the sentence that is footnoted, and then the footnote. The sentence that is footnoted reads like a statement regarding the burden of proof. That is, the presumption of res ipsa may be rebutted by evidence showing that the event resulting in the plaintiff's injuries was not due to any negligence on the defendant's part. To me, that reads more like it may be rebutted by proof that there was no negligence. But then that is the sentence. Then it says, see Graff versus Tracy, which relies on Weiss versus Axler. Footnote three consists of CRE 301, semicolon, contra Weiss. And I to me, the footnote's inscrutable. It's cryptic. I don't know what that means, C and contra, especially applied to a case that relied on Weiss and a statement that sounds like the burden of proof. But in any case, that preceded Stones Farm versus Deacon, and I mean, it can't be said to preempt it in any way, I don't think. A bit on the Ochoa versus Verrett case. As you know, that's another division of this court, and it's not binding on this division, but it became precedent when the Supreme Court declined certiorari on exactly this issue, what is the burden of proof? And I believe that the rule is that while it's not binding, a precedential decision is entitled to considerable deference. Fire Insurance Exchange case is one of many stating that. And it certainly was binding as precedent on the trial court, which declined to follow it. A bit on the other two issues, unless you have questions on the res ipsa at this point. The insufficiency of evidence, just a quick summary of what that evidence was.
Before you get there, Mr. Kerr, could you tell me, I have to tell you, I don't remember this issue being raised, and I was looking quickly in your opening brief, and I scout all the evidence issues, I see that. I'm not sure, and I need your help to direct me, where this was raised on this appeal, that there was insufficient evidence that the doctor was not negligent.
It was raised in conjunction with the, that this was not harmless error, because there was no evidence really disproving negligence, and it was raised in support of the instruction that was tendered that says, and you must find that the defendant was negligent. The lack of evidence, the insufficiency of evidence would support the giving of that and I see I have 30 seconds. I'd like to reserve that if I may at this point. Thank you.
Just to ask you on that point, why wouldn't the doctor's testimony suffice for that purpose?
Because it is just a mere denial, which is insufficient under the standard of what it takes to reach a jury, which is really what it's the directed verdict standard. The question of the purpose of the doctor was, did you comply with the standard of care? His answer was, yes, I did. That was it. There was no other testimony about standard of care or negligence. He testified to his procedure and all the ways that he does these angiograms, but that was not, first of all, personal practices are not relevant under the Walbach Bank case to establish standard of care. And secondly, that was causation testimony. He was saying, I don't remember what happened in this one, but the way I do it, this kind of injury can't happen. It's causation testimony. He never said that amounted to a standard of care. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is David Yoon, and I represent defendant appellee, Dr. James Chapman. The primary issue on appeal is whether the trial court properly instructed the jury on res ipsa locator, which did not shift the burden of proof to the defendant. Before I address that issue, I just want to talk about the sufficiency of evidence issue really quick. Plaintiff did not raise the sufficiency of evidence in their brief. I have page 7 here, which lists the issues raised in the opening brief, and it does not mention anything about sufficiency of evidence. Secondly, as Judge Kalpalki mentioned, it was rebutted by Dr. Chapman's testimony, and we attached the trial court's order denying the motion for JNOV attached to our answer brief, which details the testimony, so I won't address that right here, because I think the most important issue is the issue concerning whether it should shift the burden of proof. Now, we would submit multiple reasons why res ipsa locator does not shift the burden of proof. CRE 301, Colorado case law since the adoption of Rule 301, the original purpose of res ipsa locator, and the overwhelming majority of out-of-state cases all support the conclusion that res ipsa locator does not shift the burden of proof.
Let me ask you, Mr. Yoon, before you even get there, and I kind of, I guess, gave you a heads up of where my concern is, and I'll tell you my concern. How do you deal with Weiss? I mean, Weiss, I think, unequivocally said it shifts the burden of proof. Weiss at least has been cited with approval by the Supreme Court, whether dicta or not. We're the Court of Appeals. We can't overrule the Supreme Court. And I guess you make very powerful arguments for why it shouldn't shift the burden of proof. I get that. But I'm concerned that we're bound by Weiss. And all the discussion about whether Stone Farm dicta aside, what case has overruled Weiss, and what cases from the Supreme Court has said Weiss is not good law?
I think the starting point is the rule. Plaintiff's counsel admits that res ipsa locator is an evidentiary presumption based on your question. So there's no dispute about that. Then you have to look at Rule 301. And Rule 301 says, in all civil actions and proceedings not otherwise provided for by the statute or by these rules, referring to rules of evidence, a presumption imposes upon the party against whom it is directed the burden of going forward with the evidence to rebut or meet the presumption, but does not shift to such party the burden of proof. So you start from there, and this rule plainly applies to all civil actions and proceeding.
And if I can interrupt you, the rule clearly says what it says.
Yes.
What authority says that a rule of evidence supersedes a holding of the Colorado Supreme Court?
I will tell you, as the court may recall, three years ago, there was a case called People versus Ramirez. In that case, the Supreme Court said that insofar as there's a conflict between any case law governing the rule of common law rule of evidence and the Colorado Rules of Evidence adopted in 1980, the Colorado Rules of Evidence abrogates the common law rule. As the court will, and I will say this specifically, the court held that insofar as the language in our earlier decision suggests that expert testimony may be admitted unless it is a reasonable degree of medical probability or certainty, this standard has been abrogated by the adoption of Colorado Rules of Evidence. And that's on 155 page P3rd at 378. And I would submit the same would be true in this case.
So then what do we, and I'm sorry to monopolize your time, Mr. Young, and I'll shut up here soon. If that's the case, then how do you explain the Supreme Court's quoting the holding in Weiss in Stone's Farm, which was 12 years after Rule 301 was adopted?
So we have in Stone's Farm, which quoted Weiss, we also have another Supreme Court case, Montgomery Elevator, which Your Honor discussed, which says, describes the element and says, and citing to Rule 301, and distinguishing Wise versus Axler as contra.
And so, what do you think that means? It's a good question. I mean, one could argue it means it's just unclear which one applies, which is what Judge Webb said in Ochoa.
In addition to that, you have 3 years later, Hartford Fire. That case expressly follows Rule 301. And the Supreme Court, quoting from the jury instruction, it says, because of Rule 301, the doctrine of res ipsa locator no longer creates a presumption of negligence, which shifts the burden of disproving the presumed fact of negligence to the opponent of the presumption. The doctrine now only shifts the burden of going forward with the evidence to rebut the presumed fact. And in that case, Hartford Fire, the court actually approved of an instruction very similar to the one that was given in this case. So we have Montgomery Elevator and Hartford Fire that supports our position. What they have is Stone's Farm, which, by the way, is a footnote and is dicta because it wasn't necessary to decide the case, and the court doesn't address 301 at all.
Mr. Yoon, let me ask you, you were referring to the Ramirez case, and Ramirez was addressing which trumps, the rule or the common law?
The common law, mm-hmm. Rule of evidence, which until 2007, we believed that in order to get expert testimony into evidence, you had to have the expert testify to a reasonable degree of medical probability. And the court said the language that we previously said, it has been abrogated by the rule of evidence, which was adopted in 1980.
All right. And was that discussing a particular rule of evidence?
I believe it's 702.
All right. So in addressing 702, did 702 have language similar to Rule 301, which said, unless otherwise provided by statute or these rules? Did it have similar language?
No, it doesn't.
Okay.
But I think it's even more clear in 301 because it says, unless otherwise provided by the statute or these rules. So the only exception has to be statute or these rules. And there are no statute or other rules that provides for a different burden of proof for res ipsa locator.
Right. Well, I guess following up with that, then the exception could be a common law rule of evidence. But what you're saying is, reading Ramirez, it would trump that as well, even though the language in 301 was limited to if there's a conflict with these rules.
I'm saying Rule 301 plainly applies to all presumptions, including res ipsa locator, if you read the link, because plain, unambiguous language of the rule. And insofar as it applies, and if you believe there's a contrary case law, I am saying that it would trump it, because that's what Ramirez teaches us. That's my position. But I think more importantly, if you look at the case law, I would agree it's not all that clear whether Colorado courts are following Rule 301 or the Weiss case. That's true. but I think that we can point to Hartford that explicitly says we're following 301. And then Montgomery elevator, if that's confusing, it's no more confusing than Stone's Farm, because it's both on a footnote, both could be arguably dicta.
Well, the difference is, with all respect, I mean, Stone's Farm quoted the holding of Weiss, said it shifted the burden of proof. In Montgomery, all we have is CRE 301 contra Weiss, whatever the heck that means. I, with respect, I think those are quite different. I have a little trouble figuring out what contra meant in Montgomery, and Hartford is a court of appeals case which can't overrule Weiss.
Yep.
So I, with respect, I think they're different.
Well, a further support of that is if you look at the committee comment to Rule 301, it does cite to Weiss versus Axler and says the rule is contra to Weiss versus Axler. So it is saying the same thing I think Montgomery Elevator is saying. But in addition to that, I think, unless the court has a question, in addition to that, I'd like to go off and mention also the vast majority of other jurisdictions that refuse to shift the burden. For example, I'm going to the restatement of torts says the great majority of courts now treat res ipsa locator as creating nothing more than a permissible inference which the jury may draw or refuse to draw. CJS, which is an encyclopedia of U.S. law, says it is more widely held that the application of the doctrine shifts to the defendant the burden of producing evidence, burden of coming forward with evidence, but that the burden of proof or the ultimate burden of persuasion does not shift. ALR, says the same thing. Quote, there seems to be no real dissent from the proposition that the rule res ipsa locator, when applicable, does not affect the shift of the burden of proof. And counsel mentioned the Colorado treatise. Actually, there is John Grund, the personal injury practice, that recognizes that Rule 301 trumps the Weiss versus Axler. So there is Colorado treatise saying to the contrary to what counsel said.
Our problem is the Supreme Court trumps Mr. Grun for our purposes.
Yes, I'm just pointing out the treatise.
I understand.
And then I think if the court looks at the original purpose of res ipsa locator, that I don't think res ipsa locator had anything to do with shifting the burden of proof. Res ipsa locator was to deal with circumstantial evidence when there's no specific evidence of negligence. And it was not intended to do anything to do with burden of proof. And restatement second comment A explains that. It says, in its inception, the principle of res ipsa locator was merely a rule of evidence, permitting the jury to draw from the occurrence of an unusual event the conclusion that it was the defendant's fault. Shortly after its origin, however, it became confused. In cases of injuries to passengers at the hands of the carriers with the older rule that placed the burden of proof. And then it goes on to say, this confusion resulted in a great deal of disagreement among the courts as to the application of the principle. So when the purpose is properly considered, I think the trial court correctly refused to shift the burden of proof. And lastly, I just want to mention the harmless error argument. Even if the court were to conclude that the instruction was improper because it shifted the burden, it was harmless because we submit that no res ipsa instruction should have been given in the first place. The trial court, and if the court concludes that no instruction should have been given, it's immaterial whether that the instruction shifted the burden or didn't shift the burden. In medical malpractice case, and this is Williams versus Boyle case, it says res ipsa applies where the cause of injury is so apparent that a lay person is as able as an expert to conclude that such things do not happen in the absence of negligence. In this case, both parties presented conflicting expert testimony concerning the alleged cause of injury and whether such an injury could have occurred in the absence of negligence. Dr. Chapman testified about this subject, and it was beyond the understanding of ordinary jurors as to how a cardiac angiogram is performed, what a guide wire is, and what an aortic arch is, how a guide wire is used, the strength of an aortic arch, and whether a guide wire can perforate an aortic arch. Because plaintiff's claim was beyond the common ken of an ordinary juror, and because an expert testimony was necessary, we submit that the trial court should not have given the instruction in the first place. And if that's the case, I think the court concluded that it was harmless error, and we did raise this argument in our briefs. I believe if the court needs the cite, it's in pages 703, 712, as well as CD pages 1494, 1505.
I understand that there was an argument that you would have to have had a cross appeal in order to assert that.
Well, I think that's not true because there's a case on point on that. Colorado case have held that an appellee as opposed to an appellant can ask for affirmance of the judgment on any grounds supported by the record, whether or not it was decided by the trial court or not. And I believe there's a specific case saying no cross appeal is necessary. In that case, Blocker Exploration versus Frontier Exploration, Inc., 740 P. 2nd, 983, page 989. My time is up, so please stand by our brief. Thank you.
In just a few seconds, just on the harmless error point, the rule requiring expert testimony that the Williams case was a certificate of review case, and that's the context in which expert testimony was discussed. Holmes case and the Miller case clearly state that actually res ipsa loquitur, where it is not something that is within the lay person's ken, expert testimony is required, actually, on the issue of whether this could not have happened in the absence of negligence. So the cross appeal, I don't think the Blocker case applies. I think a cross appeal was required, that, and this was a waiver. This is an instructional error issue, which Blocker doesn't apply to. And then one tiny last point on the briefs called all of the other jurisdictions in the country, or almost all of them, an overwhelming majority. They're actually, our reply brief does set out how those citations were in some places miscited and their omissions and their misstatements of the law. They're cases from Nevada, New York, Ohio, Arkansas, Louisiana, Maine, and so on, that in which the burden of proof does shift. It's a minority rule, but it was overstated and misstated in the brief.
All right, your time is up. Thank you. All right, thank you. Excellent arguments on both sides. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. Thank you.